This is a Decentered podcast from Rob Watson, conversations about community media. Look out for Decentered Media on Twitter and on iTunes, or go to decentered.co.uk. Hello, it's Monday the 24th of February, and this is a Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. And today I'm talking over the internet with Russell Todd and Andy Green, who are, I don't know how to describe it really, you're promoting a week about social capital around the project, the Grow Social Capital Project. Do you want to jump in and tell us a little bit about the background to it and what it's involving this week?
Okay, so Russell and I have been working with each other for a number of years, and we recognise that actually many of the problems society faces, there's a root cause of changing levels in what's called social capital, that people are less connecting with each other, there's less resource to help each other, and we decided to do something about it by joining with others to launch Social Capital Week this week.
Yeah, I mean, our paths have crossed, both in a professional context at football, there was a meeting of minds. Albeit we've got quite contrasting backgrounds in a professional sense. Mark and being, you know, a communications PR expert guru. Am I allowed to do that?
They call me guru because I can't spell charlatan.
And mine's sort of community development, which I've spoken to you, Rob, about for this podcast before. But there is, I think there's a sort of like a, if you were to sort of Venn diagram it, I think there is a sweet spot in the middle where these two disciplines, which on paper might be quite different, quite disparate, sort of come together. And really the conversations around social capital, we're both disciples of it, if that's not too grand a word to call it. And we just felt there was something that we could do to just raise awareness, consciousness around the importance of it as a concept. I think people tend to, certainly a lot of policy I read around sort of communities and resilient communities and empowerment, they're kind of getting, they're touching on it, it's within grasp. But I think until or unless they get a better fundamental understanding and grasp of social capital, what it is and how as well you generate it and retain it as well, then I think too much of these policies tend to just sort of wither on the vine a little bit, and these strategies, which I've been, you know, party to several in the community sense in Wales. So I just thought this week we would do something around trying to focus attention and people, you know, create a bit more of an audience, I suppose, for the week. And what was timely about it and really quite serendipitous was the Office for National Statistics published some data that essentially approved, in inverted commas, certainly churned out a whole lot of data around less trust in society, less contact between people, less interaction, more polarized media, and all sorts. So I think we've as much by chance as design, we've landed on a good time to maybe start looking at this, and we'd like it to maybe become an annual thing.
So what you
work? The time has come to address this.
Sorry, Andy, say that again.
Sorry, the time has come to address this issue because it's underpins all various social ills in society, and you see reports, studies, and they go into great depth, but without mentioning the word social capital, which really is the elephant in the room in terms of the issue, but because it's not recognised, there's a really failure to do constructive, practical things to address the problem.
So give us a working definition that you use then, that you find both in practical terms and in, if you like, theoretical terms, what social capital is.
I like the phrase, it's how we help each other to help each other. So that it's that capacity we have to, ranging from a shared social contact, a shared identity, to just being able to do small things for each other that we can often take for granted, but then notice it's gone when people stop doing like the like thank yous, informal stuff of people tell us about years ago when the coal man delivered coal in the street. If there's an elderly person, the neighbour would shift their coal for them. And it's the modern day equivalent of that would be just being aware of our neighbours, our society, getting involved in community groups, even things like buying a local newspaper. I was in a a music shop in my hometown of Barry, and that's really struggling at the moment because it's got competition from online. And many people who were local have stopped using it because the connections have gone. That the local authority had used to use local music teachers, and they use their local music shop. The local authority now gets music teachers from far and wide, and they don't use the local music shop. And before you know it, we've lost a valuable asset in our community. So if your band's got a gig on, you want to put a poster in the shop, or just talk to another musician, or need something urgent at hand, you don't get that from Amazon, but you would do from your local music shop.
What about you, Russell, from kind of practical experience? How do you define what social capital is?
I think if you look at it from the point of view of, you know, we refer to things like society and what is it? And, you know, somebody famously said there was no such thing as it. But I think if you look at aspects of sort of social structure, the institutions, the movements that we make, the spaces we inhabit, the institutions we engage with as well, whether we create them at a very local grassroots level or whether they are, you know, state level or municipality level and that sort of thing, the ones we engage with, services we access, I think it's the sum total, if you like, and the value of the interactions and the contacts that they bring about. And I think by value, it's almost refers to this intrinsic kind of humanity in us. I think these things are humane. They are more humane when we engage with them in a very sort of physical sort of sense, where things are proximate to us and we are to them. I think it leads to better democracy, it leads to better decision-making, it leads to better sort of policies, but it also leads, like Andy sort of alluded to with the coal man, you know, milk bottles on the doorstep was an indication that somebody, you know, wasn't at home or was ill or something was wrong in the household. You know, very little milk gets delivered these days. And so those eyes and ears are lacking somewhat. And that's not to say that there's not other ways of doing it via social media, but like the ONS data said, what we're doing is sacrificing even familial contact, you know, within within sort of kin and family relationships. Those are being sacrificed for interactions on social media. And social media is great. And you and I have had a conversation about social media before. And what was interesting, listening to your last podcast with the Also Coffee Crew, which sounds like a lovely place I'd like to go to if I ever, when they get the Leicester, you know, they're talking about, you know, use of social media. And it's great for communicating your values and things like that. It's not to say it's this kind of evil, but I think it's coming at a bit of a price to the more kind of traditional sort of, as I said, physical interactions.
The danger is, isn't it, that we've got a kind of nostalgia, you know, the milk float wandering up and down the street, you know, is something I remember as a kid, but that's 40 years ago. You know, what drives this? You know, it seems to me that there's two pulling in two directions. One, there's a kind of a lag about people's understanding of the changes of sociality within our communities and our society, and the other one is the kind of technological efficiency driven processes, information driven processes that kind of give us lots of information. But as you say, you know, it's the self-service checkout in the supermarket model, isn't it? You know, very efficient, drives down costs for the business, but leaves people feeling, you know, dehumanized. Where do we sit in the middle of that in order to be able to not just jump down the nostalgic route, but also not to, you know, become overly obsessed with that? There's a technological solution for this.
Yeah, the seminal book on the subject of social capital is by Robert Putnam, probably familiar with, called Bowling Alone, where he highlighted how in the United States, bowling alley attendance is on the rise, yet bowling league team participation has plummeted. In my hometown of Barry in South Wales, I think we were doing an equivalent book, it would be called Skittling No More, where half the number of skittle alleys are now closed. And so what we can't do is argue for the sustainability of an action and a product that people don't necessarily want anymore. What we can do is realise the social capital dividend from it, and then use that to look for where we can apply it in a more modern context. So in Barry, every Saturday morning, we have over 300 runners doing a park run. And yet, I really see there's great potential there, not only do people come along and run, but also to yield the social capital potential. So there's a lot of things we're doing where we're coming together, and we need to be a bit savvier, smarter about social capital so that we can then make sure that where we have got opportunities, we can make the most of them. Whereas at the moment, because it's not on the radar, let's say changing habits are leading to a destruction of former ways people connect with each other, and we're not really sort of smart enough and keen enough to actually tap into new opportunities. Hence why we need to be people understand what social capital is, what they can do, developing new tools and techniques and so on, that we can help people harvest the potential for social capital in their communities.
One of the ways that we make change tangible for people is that they can identify with the people who, you know, people like themselves who've gone through similar kinds of changes, a sense of belonging and the way that change is communicated. Is this a challenge of really people are not educated enough or have the capacity to deal with significant social, technical, institutional, global change? Or is this something which is kind of, kind of more deeper rooted? Because, you know, it's motherhood and apple pie to some extent, isn't it? You know, it's I'm being devil's advocate with this for you, promote some argument, but it's, it sounds great. You know, all of this social capital, you know, get back to a model of, you know, that was partly one of the issues with Putnam's model. But actually, the former models, you know, of social arrangement, like the village, and there's that book, The Village Effect, which, you know, the village wasn't necessarily a nice place for people to live. Yes, people knew each other and looked after each other in different ways, but it had other problems as well, like a kind of overbearance and control and, you know, kind of nobody could do anything without everybody else. You know, there was no privacy issues and there was no aspiration to move on from this, you know, the situation that we were in. How do we balance that kind of, you know, kind of desire to kind of keep things that we valued in the past, but at the same time move on to do new things in the future?
I think the challenges that our social capital, particularly Putnam's work inspired initiatives like the Big Society, and it was seen as a magic wand where, yes, we could go back to golden days of yesteryear, and yes, we could all help each other much more. And really failed. Two major failings really with the Big Society was, one, that it was seen as owned by the government and a top-down initiative. And secondly, not recognising that, as you rightly have indicated there, that social capital can be a double-edged sword. It can be that actually, yes, it can inspire people to do magnificent things in the cause of the community. Equally, it can be a negative thing, like for doing terrible things that, you know, be dangerous, injure people, beat up people, kill people even, in the name of a shared identity and the social capital in the situation. So the challenge is there, it's been too simplified as a magic wand and as something that's done top down, whereas in hindsight, I think they've been far better reframing Big Society as big citizenship. It's about how each and every one of us can be a bigger person through every incidental activity to harness good, at the same time as being mindful that, sometimes knowing about your neighbour too much or something can be a negative. So it's getting that balance right. But at the moment, there's no real sort of pushing for putting social capital on the agenda.
Yeah, I think that honesty then, that Andy kind of illustrates there, I think is one of the pushbacks against the criticism of it being, you know, as you say, Rob, motherhood and apple pie. There are plenty of very kind of homogenous sort of demographically speaking, culturally speaking, linguistically speaking kind of communities back in the day that, you know, never saw somebody with a different color of skin, encountered someone with a different faith, etc. And we're not romanticizing that sort of homogeneity at all. But I think, you know, unless we are able to articulate the virtues of having connections with people who have, you know, different faiths, no faith indeed, you know, who are different genders, different sexualities, you know, different ages, etc., then I think, you know, I think society is a little bit, I'd say it's poorer, but it's certainly less enriched, if that's a different way of trying to make the same point.
And I think one of the key lessons, we talk about growing distrust, we've got to listen to each other more. And really the heart of good listening is a greater empathy. And if you can listen to someone who you either met or in the street or know someone like or similar, that's a far better starting point than someone whose views are going to be unfamiliar to you, alien, and therefore, as I say, there's not that willingness and propensity to fully engage and fully listen.
Let's just for a minute just think through, because there's a problem with the analogy that this is based around, isn't it? The word capital. And it's a kind of balance sheet approach, which says that, you know, you can tot up, you can add up the totality of the good in a community. And maybe that is a question of how it's distributed equitably and equally throughout that community. So the squire in the village had considerable amounts of social capital and the peasants had very little, that kind of thing, at its extreme end. But the model of a kind of a balance sheet approach where you can shift where the value is around a community from it's akin to financial thinking. Does that not undermine the idea? I mean, I like the way that you drew the distinction, Andy, about citizenship. Is it the same thing, that what it does is it forces us to think in a particular way, that you just need to put some financial control mechanisms in place and therefore you can respond to some of these problems, rather than talking about principles of value and solidarity and belonging and all of those things that feed into it?
I think there's a couple of things there. Firstly, that we've got to get away from a transactional model where, like as you say there, if I do this, then I'm expecting this. We live in a world where scientists are comfortable in studying our cosmos of a concept of dark matter, where there's stuff, areas of the cosmos, they've got no idea what goes in there, what's happening, but they accept that as a reality. And I think that being all emotionally driven beings, we've got our equivalent in our relationships. And I think one of the critical things going forward is promoting the idea that in any sort of community engagement, community activity, we've got to recognise we need a bigger dashboard. So it's beyond the KPIs of conventional regeneration programme, and then there's a wider dividend. And often sometimes that dividend may only emerge through the actions of the programme. Whereas the danger is you get too transactional, too prescriptive, then, as I say, it can lead to people being over-focused, actually nullifying or being counterproductive to generating the very asset we're seeking to build and nurture and celebrate in our communities.
Yeah, I think you're right, Rob, to be the least cautious about what I think it's potentially quite a reductionist thing, a reductive thing to say that, you know, it operates by the same rules as any other form of capital. It's just merely a, you know, less or sort of more benign, more cuddlier, woollier sort of version. I think one of the things we want to do with this social capital week running this week until, you know, between the 24th, 20th of February is almost maybe kind of mischievously tease some of that thinking out, actually. To what extent is that held as a thought or as an understanding or interpretation of social capital in different aspects of you know, the public sector or the voluntary third sector or whatever. I don't for one second say that, you know, that what we want to do this week and what, you know, the mission of Grow Social Capitalist, this sort of social enterprise that Andy and I have kind of put together to take this sort of mission forward is, you know, is saying, you know, it's our way or the highway type stuff. What we're looking for is to have that debate and that discussion, and to sort of stress test and critique, you know, some of the concepts and some of people's understanding and interpretation of them. Because I agree with, again, that notion of, you know, that picture you painted between the, you know, the proles and the squire, and some of the community development literature, sort of the turn of the century, around, you know, connected communities and this notion of a sort of like a networked approach to community development, which I'm very, very sympathetic towards, where you don't, in some sort of Saul Alinsky way, try to circle the wagons and you try to create a them and an us. And it's a very competitive way of sort of saying, okay, the enemy is out there, we're all together. Where you instead you work through networks and you try to kind of almost like island hopping, you jump from island to island and you try to create connections between those networks. And then you try to strengthen those networks. That literature, that kind of philosophy, to my mind, at the turn of the century within community development theory, was very much grounded in the notion that areas that had less crime and less litter and were prettier and had a bit more of a bit more of an appealing sort of town centre, they had more social capital. The so-called sink estates on the side of the valley in South Wales coalfield or on the outskirts of city centres or any city areas, you know, they lacked it. And I think that bothered me then. And I understand now, reading a bit more kind of like, for example, people like Raymond Williams, that actually was very pejorative thinking about the very people that community workers and community development was there to support and assist and mobilise and energise and so on. So I think what we're trying to do is you know, maybe, you know, try to sort of put a few sort of squares in blocks in round holes, but it's trying to sort of tease out what it is that people understand or misunderstand by some of this, or maybe they're misapplying it in certain ways, I guess.
Yeah. And one negative reaction I get from people about social capital, they say, oh, it's about old boys' networks and that's unfair and therefore we shouldn't engage with it. Let's learn, understand the tools, the way it works, and then harness that for the use of wider social good, rather than reject it outright. We've got an opportunity here to, you know, be savvier, smarter, more empathetic, more growing up from the bottom up in terms of how we change, and rather than, as I say, a top-down prescriptive route that tells people what to do rather than listens and establishes genuine partnerships with them.
Because there's a lot of organisations who are focusing on this and the associated ideas, aren't they? You know, kind of major funding organisations and charitable bodies are behind this, and corporate social responsibility is behind it, and all of those kind of things. Let's think for a little bit then in terms of some examples. I think it's good to kind of put some meat on the bones and think about, you know, what's in your experience there in Cardiff that you've seen that has, you know, kind of led on this, or you know, if it's not quite apparent that this is happening, you know, where would you like to see it happening and taking place?
We've involved in a number of community projects around Cardiff. So in Barry, we're involved in a project called the Barry Ideas Bank. That addressed the question. Is it Leicester you're from, Rob?
Based in Leicester, yeah.
Yeah, so, but where do you go in Leicester if you've got an idea to make Leicester better? And, you know, it's the same challenge wherever you live, that there's a host of ideas, energy, enthusiasm, but where does it go? So we had the concept of a community ideas bank, and we, in our trial projects, we've shown how it can harness the talents and energies of people to the wider good, but combining, we've touched upon before about is online good or bad? Well, I think there's a place for it. And the lesson we found from our Ideas Bank project was that actually the idea of a website where you go to put your ideas on, it didn't work. The unexpected consequences were that actually the key lesson we learned was that actually an idea by itself is just an idle thought. But an idea is only as powerful as the person behind it, and they're only as powerful as the people behind them.
Well, so that's a really nice framework for that. I like that.
So going forward, it's really about there's a role for online to be supportive, to be a connector, and to be a sort of another space to connect and combine with. But to lead with it is the lesson we've learned is actually you've got to work through the people, work offline. We have a phrase that from a sales and background and marketing background, there's a concept that to land a sale, you need 7 quality contacts. I think the experience we've found from actually getting people to do things in a community, you need about 70 nudges. So it's about being that sort of providing a constancy, a sense of space, but then the chivying, the nudging, the G-ing along was absolutely critical. And you can only do that, say, as face-to-face in relationships rather than through online tools. So I think the future is really blended, but rather than being online-led, I think it's in tandem, but you know, it's face-to-face-led, supported by online. So lots of valuable lessons there we've picked up from looking to put what we're thinking into practice.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that fuels that is this notion of reciprocity. So rather than it be a purely a transactional thing or there's a danger actually just taking that at very face value, talking about nudges and prompts and things like that, that it's almost perhaps some sort of coercive effect. But I think, and clearly people's values and motive have to be, kind of analysed, I suppose, and held up to challenge. You know, what are we wanting people, what are we nudging people to do? But within that, I think, is this notion of reciprocity. And it tends to happen and it tends to be beneath the radar or... it's very, very subtle, but I think it's very, very important, particularly in those communities, then, which is my background, as you know, Rob, where you areas that are tend to be more disadvantaged, lack that sort of cultural capital, was the phrase a few years ago that used to be used. They lack the capacity then, and maybe resources to make the change that they want. And I think austerity has hollowed out so much of the public realm and the social realm. Particularly then for what I do in terms of community work, there's very few community workers now inhabiting those spaces between, you know, working at the interface between sectors or working between different kind of communities of space characteristics, whatever they people want to define themselves as, not want to be defined at all. That actually you look at it, this concept of having to try to do more with less. You know, there's only so much you can hack kind of public budgets back to. So we need to look at it not in that balance sheet way. I think this is one of the things we would push back about, that very simplistic, I'd argue, reductive critique of social capital. We have to go beyond that, those balance sheets. It's not just about cuts and budget cuts and council budgets, etc. And begin to look at, okay, what is it that people can do if they come together? And you look at it very much from that asset-based approach. Coming at this social capital concept from my background then as a community worker, I would say that community development needs to be at the heart of that. But we've looked, you know, I've got a, just looking at it, you know, this morning, it's something we're going to try to critique this week. You know, the Welsh Government here in Wales has published a sort of like a strategy called Connected Communities. And it's talking about, you know, 20 mile per hour zones around schools and schools making their resources and facilities available to communities. All of this I've read, I don't know how many times over the years, but it doesn't actually mention the phrase social capital. And until or unless, I think, in terms of policy, there's a recognition of what it is and how you can kind of create it. And also what forces, be they economic, cultural, political, or whatever, or combined, serve to leech it out. Then these policies will come and go, as they've all too often done in the past, and will not really make much of an impact. By and large, they'll just kind of, you know, go flying off the surface because they can't penetrate and get beneath what's going on in communities.
Yeah. And it's not just semantics, but I believe words are tools, and the more accurate and precise our tools, the more we can progress with diversity. You always need to make an ask. And in any social encounter, there are often the golden moments. You go to the doctor's, diagnose you, gives you a prescription, and you say, thank you, doctor. And at that point, there's a golden moment where if the doctor was to pose an ask, he'd be very receptive and likely to respond positively. And yet that moment in most encounters goes untapped, underused. And we always say that there's at least three basic asks you should always ask of people, provide. One is feedback, you know, how do we do, can we get better? Secondly, word of mouth, can you spread the word on about what you've just had or any other issue? And thirdly, share any learning. And I think what reciprocity does, it provides a resource, which is where it's been a driver for big society and so on. But I think the more crucial thing is it changes the narrative. So if you don't make the ask, it's you, the doctor or whoever, with your magic wand, granting a wish to transform another person's situation. If you make an ask, however, what you're doing is you're changing you together on a journey where you're going to have many ups and downs, but together you're going to create a better place, arrive at a better place through your joint efforts. So I think it's not just about making the ask to get results, but to fundamental change the narrative of you together to create a better place, as opposed to I've got the power, I've got the magic wand, and hey, I'm transforming you.
There's he's increasingly famous GP, David Unwin up in Southport. He's known as on Twitter as the low carb GP, and I'm quite a fan of the kind of his approach, both in terms of what he does for he's managed to book the trend and reduce the number of people in the practice that he works in, to reduce the amount of diabetes medication and to decrease the kind of general weight levels of the obesity of his patients. And he's done that by adopting a certain type of diet, which is to avoid processed foods, basically, and to offer, and his wife's a psychologist, so they kind of work very closely together. And I went to see a talk with him at the University of Leicester last year. He said the other ingredient in this, you know, that thing that you just said about, you know, the asks, is to offer some hope that you can make changes without being on a lifetime of medication. And I tweeted him about this and said the other ingredient that you do, which you don't necessarily get the recognition for, is he runs peer-led, if you like, patient groups it's a community development approach, and they meet on a weekly basis, and new patients are introduced, and they learn from each other's examples, and they define and, you know, feed back into the process within the practice to how they shape and develop the ongoing support for this. But it kind of bridges that, you know, that kind of three-way. You know, it's got the word of mouth in there. It's got the feedback for the clinicians, but it's also got that element to it of sharing your learning. And I just wonder, there's kind of two, the reciprocity phrase. That was something I'd written down at the beginning of the conversation. But the other one is, for me, is contribution. You can't have social. You know, do we ask people enough to, you know, what is your contribution to this? We live in a service economy, and we run services, and people say, I'm entitled to get this, and the council should sort this out, and the government should provide the framework for this. Do we need to shift this back to asking people, well, what's your contribution to dealing with this?
I think one of the things we want to do this week as part of Social Capital Week is raise awareness of a couple of models that are out there that I think lend themselves to those sorts of discussions, Rob, to be perfectly honest. I'll let Andy introduce one, but for me, one is that Wigan deal. And I know it's beginning to gain some traction in sort of local government circles in Wales, for example, but it does, again, seems to be those, perhaps a bit like, is it David Unwin,
yep,
the name?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't familiar with him. As soon as you're talking, he conjured up, his work conjured up the name of Julian Tudor Hart, who again was this pioneering GP in the Avon Valley in South Wales and the Coalfield in South Wales. And, you know, he undertook action research within his practices, and he pioneered routine preventative healthcare. But he was one of the first GPs to recognise the intrinsic kind of connection between social and that sort of, you know, medical, clinical sort of treatment, and wanted to break the barriers down between those two. And what we would call what he did in the 70s, co-production, now we were talking about, it wasn't called that in those days. He just wanted to be a little bit more of his people and among his community. So I would be amazed if David Unwin probably hasn't maybe drawn on Julian Tudor Hart's work. But again, you know, what he would do was ask questions about, well, what else can I do for you? But, you know, are there some things that you can do for me? Are there some things that you can do for yourselves? Are there some things that you can do for your neighbours, and so on? And to have that very much hardwired into his, you know, his general practice. You know, the Wigan deal does something very, very similar, just very simply in plain language. And I think that is a key thing here underpinning all of this. In very plain language, it sets out that if people in Wigan do X, Y, and Z, the local authority, and I think it goes beyond just the local authority, will do, you know, A, B, and C. And again, it's a very reciprocal arrangement between, you know, what might be, you know, very remote, perhaps abstract, you know, impenetrable institutions that traditionally have held power and which people can't influence. And I think that's quite refreshing.
I think what you touch upon there is there's marvellous case studies, and the challenge is if we can understand the underlying mechanics of how they work, they can then make them more transferable. That's why we're keen to, A, get people to recognise social capital, but then also know like the dynamics of how it can be cultivated, nurtured. We've also developed another model. We call it the Manchester model, inspired by some work we did with MIND, the mental health charity in Northwest. And I think one of the challenges we've got is the word partnership is almost seen as a grubby word, in the sense that it's been so abused, with partnerships of unequals.
Yeah.
With the Manchester model, what we firstly suggest is that you work in partnerships, but it's partnerships of equals. And you can establish that equality by identifying your values and narrative and establishing where there's joint commonality there in terms of where you're coming together. And I think the second thing is really establishing this bigger dashboard. So it's not just the immediate measures, but are there wider dividends? And so going forward in that the case in MIND, they had the challenge of providing face-to-face mental health advice without the resource available to fund for someone to sit the other side of the desk of the client. And the solution was that I'm trying to find another word other than for the V word, I call it the volunteer. But they realised they had a great asset in terms of knowledge in managing and training, but didn't have the resource to actually fund the person. So they realised there was goodwill and resource out there where they could train people up to do that face-to-face advice, who were volunteers, weren't paid, but enabled the collective resource to achieve result. And going back to the bigger dashboard, there's a wider dividend that then there's people not only just volunteering for MIND, but it empowered them, made them super social capitalists in the sense of going beyond just that. So, and lastly, then by adding reciprocity, you then got a collective where people, you know, change the narrative is how everyone together, a much bigger community of people, are working together to realise the change they want.
I listened to a webinar a few weeks ago from over in Canada, and it's the Life Schoolhouse. And they have a model in, I mean, North America does, you know, obviously that's where Putnam was writing, particularly in the United States, but the model of home-based community activities. And this Life Schoolhouse is offering things like cookery classes, or if you've got a kind of an interest or expertise in wine, you'll run a wine class or something like that in your neighbourhood. But you do it from your home. I can't see that taken off in the UK. It's like inviting your neighbours in to learn about your record collection or something like that. You know, is there a cultural element to this that we maybe need to start to trying to get over? You know, I don't know what the English are like. What are the Welsh like in terms of, well, you know, that reticence to kind of engage with one each other? We like the English, particularly at this particular time, like their bloody mindedness.
I've worked in South Wales Valleys communities, and I can tell you they can be pretty bloody minded as well on occasions. I mean, just on the issue of Putnam, I think, yes, he most famously, I suppose, most people's, I tweeted something along the same point earlier today. Most people's entry point to this concept is Putnam's Bowling Alone. And Putnam was an American, and, you know, bowling is one of those definitively, almost quintessentially American pastimes, like, you know, like baseball and basketball. But a lot of his research was actually in Italy before that, and was looking at sort of civic society within Italian society. Or Italian community, should I say, which, you know, to my mind, and maybe being a bit sort of glib and stereotypical, tend to be very matriarchal, very family oriented, close supply chains, the importance of eating together, but not just eating together, preparing the food together. Yeah. And, he extrapolated from a lot of that work, that research, that democracy was stronger at a local level, and then it built up and stronger above that by focusing on those interactions and those connections. And what I think is interesting is off the back of I know what your rule is about mentioning the B word.
You can mention it, that's fine, but you have to buy the first beer.
Yeah, okay. And I think I probably owe you about 4 or 5 already because of this. I think there's a sense that post Brexit, but post referendum then, but because of the ensuing debate since related to Brexit, is that people have become polarized and debate has become polarized, and there was a bit of a glib sort of knee-jerk reaction to this notion. I think some kind of people across Emily Dick was from Glastonbury was one of the signatories, and there was kind of sports people, and I think the Bishop of Archbishop of Canterbury mentioned something about and wanting to kind of heal these divides, wants the country to be united. And my issue, my worry was with it, it's all well intended, don't get me wrong, and they're encouraging people to kind of reach out and make contact with a stranger or somebody at the very least you haven't had contact with for a while. And I understand the motive behind it, and I'm not against it, per se, but making that connection in some way sort of a top-down thing that government needs to start this decade of reconnection. Institutions have to do it. And I think what's interesting is that you go back to Putnam and also done research before that. And actually, to my mind, what feels a bit more intuitively the way forward anyway, just based on my lived experience and where I've worked and where I live and my connections, actually, that trust, it starts closer to home. It doesn't start by what sounds to me possibly, and again, I'm trying not to be critical, sounds to me just like another variation on, big society. And just a bit kind of glib and banal kind of sound bites.
I would challenge you, Robert, saying, doing stuff from home is American, not British. I'm a great believer in the phrase that here is just unevenly distributed. So the better world we want, we're witnessing. And then the Northwest has come across some great case studies there of knitting circles. Obviously, in the middle class context, you've got book clubs. So there is a model there, and people are doing this activity. And I think the lesson really is about working out emergence, work from the bottom up, rather than impose on people, as Russell said, a top-down directive. Just recognise the positive action activities are there, and encourage that, and broaden the circulation of them, as opposed to sort of being directional from above. Work with people, and from the home is where change starts.
I suppose I agree with you, but there is a counter argument which I think has to be taken into account, is that, and we are seeing the evidence of this now, I think, is that the communities that have been affected least by austerity have the strongest amounts of social capital. So who published the report a few weeks ago? Is it the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, about the distribution of things like charitable trusts and civic community groups? And the Cotswolds has one of the highest areas, and the Northwest, of England has one of the lowest areas in patches. And, unless you have some kind of redistribution and support for those areas which don't have, we've got this phrase being used at the moment, levelling up, which will be an interesting thing to see in practice, because otherwise, and Russell, you've mentioned this before, I seem to remember in the past, about these things resort back to those people who've got the capacity and the capability, rather than us directing these things to the areas that are of most need. How do we deal with that challenge?
I would say, and I'm biased and it's not particularly imaginative, I would go back to a community development approach, which just, puts resource into an energy into those communities where there's a perceived deficit then of something or other, but then builds on the assets that they've got. So although they may well be then just taking that metric of sort of charitable causes between the Cotswolds and whatever the other place was you mentioned, Rob. You know, you still focus on the fact that there is still some charitable action taking place. There is still some organising taking place, and then you look to invest in it and build on that. But what you do is you help mobilise those people to themselves to do it. And I think that for me has always been the way you go about it. And there's models within that. Like I said, there's networked approach. There's a community organising approach, which was essentially Alinsky, and then Hillary Clinton was a disciple of Alinsky. Obama was in Chicago, where Alinsky tended to be associated with. So I think there's some going back to the future, as it were, approaches to some of that. But I think what you have to recognise is that there is inequality within the union of the UK. There is inequality, economically speaking. There's inequality within England then. This is not an anti-English thing. And I think what we have are some very, some sort of creases in the kind of constitutionally speaking, where you're looking at things like the policy devolution that I still think haven't quite been ironed out yet. And there's still a bit of work to do. Just on the notion of comparing areas on metrics, I think a really fascinating piece of work originated out of Scotland called Understanding Scottish Place, and there's an Understanding Welsh Place kind of parallel initiative that's much more in its infant stages. But what that tends to do, and what for me really fundamentally, critically, does is it rejects this notion of league tables, that there is somebody at the top, there's a Liverpool, and at the bottom there's a Norwich City. And what it does, it recognises that there's interconnections between all of these, and so it looks to map the degree of connectedness between towns, crucially towns, not cities, I should sort of state. And that's what they're looking to do with Wales, and it creates a strong, robust data set. So that although the Cotswolds, in a traditional league table kind of meritocratic kind of analysis, and I would argue a deficit analysis, this is what it has, and this is what the others don't have. The Cotswolds is still reliant on, it is still dependent on, it is still connected to its hinterland, its neighbouring, the neighbouring valley, the neighbouring town, the neighbouring suburb. And what this data set does in this analysis of place, although specifically towns in this context, is it recognises that and it brings it to the surface. And I think that's really, really important that we do away with these league table type approaches. And the same, I'm sure people in the education sector would say the same about schools, and in health they would say the same about hospitals and the like.
Yeah. If I can pick up Rob's point about how addressing an issue is focusing on the point of most need, I think we need what I call a double barrel approach, where yes, you focus on need, but also you actually focus on where things are going really well, where there's strength, where there's a vibrancy and aliveness in the community. And rather than just being ignoring those and putting them in a separate dimension, you actually look to connect and then engage with their wider community. Right, but at the moment, everyone just focused on, we focus 100% resource on those in most need, rather than actually creating connections and building from the ground up, where there's asset, where there's connectivity, where there's people doing good things. And I think we need to get away from this over-focused, one-shot approach.
They need the voice. Those people themselves need a voice and need to have some way in which it's articulated so that they identify themselves what the needs are, or put it another way, what their aspirations are. All too often, even if you take that approach, all too often it is those that have the power are defining the need. Yeah, and that's not to say it hasn't been informed by a survey or some sort of notional tokenistic consultation, but all too often that need is being prescribed for the people who are deemed to be needy then.
Yeah, I agree. So if you've got a resource that's within the community connecting, like the idea we have with the Ideas Bank project, where you connect good areas of vibrancy and potency with areas people needing help, but from within the community is the way forward. As Rob Russell rightly says, I mean, a top-down approach inevitably brings then the shortcomings of directional and not fully engaging and not fully being of the people.
And a managerialism, and I think that's affected a lot of...
Ooh, don't know what that was. Sorry, something interrupted then. I think I pressed the wrong button on something. Sorry, carry on.
No, didn't hear anything, was there?
No.
Managerialism. I think that's what's kind of infected, for want of a better word, a lot of the discourse and the policy arena, really, certainly from my perspective in Wales, but I think it's elsewhere. And I think it's a hangover a little bit from sort of New Labour, but and that kind of Giddens sort of underpinned approach. But it'll hit targets and miss the point, to use the old cliche. And I just see a bit more of it in just some of the things I've been reading this last couple of weeks by way of sort of preparation for this social capital week.
The kind of flavour of this podcast is loosely community media, increasingly loosely community media. I think it's conversations that inform people who are community media advocates and practitioners, and that's why this talk about social value is so important. But I noted last week that there was a couple of reports and a couple of state blogs that had been written, and whenever these documents are published, whether it was the government's civil society strategy, media isn't included in them. What do you think the role is of media to facilitate and contribute towards the development of social capital and social gain? Why is community media not being picked up by the foundations and the large charities and the government departments to see forms of community media as something which actually contributes towards all the things that we've just been talking about?
I think there's an element that they get overlooked because they're between as opposed to seen as a direct source in themselves. Secondly, also, I actually think we need to really reframe what we mean by media. So that there's everything. So, for example, when I'm in London, I go around proudly wearing my Tube chat badge, which an initiative to promote people to chat on the Tube. So even a simple badge there is a medium. I'm passionate that, as I say, we live in not only an era of changing social capital, but in terms of media capital, profound changes in media models. And there's a critical need for media, not just to be a news medium, but, for example, the Ideas Bank, where there was an idea that was then shared between people, put on an online space. That in itself is a critical medium for engaging people. So I think the challenge you have, I was working with an organization last month where they're trying to encourage collaboration, and their efforts really amount to creating events where people come together. And I think we've just got to be a bit more savvier and smarter about how collaboration works, how we need media across a full spectrum of community media and any other form of engagement and nudging to work there. But you're right that this, community media can be the Cinderella of policy and change in this area. And I think what we might witness with traditional models really severely being eroded, that it might give the space for more community media to emerge, and emerge in a sense that providing a valuable role. So, whether it's a school a PTA newsletter through to an online resource, there's a lot of potential out there.
Yeah, I wonder whether sort of campaigns then, for example, and some of the reports that you're alluding to, Rob, and you've shared several with us that we wouldn't have been aware of otherwise. So we're grateful for that, because it has informed some of our kind of thinking and some of our output that's going to come later this week. I just wonder whether it's something a bit more simplistic, is that, they're still trying to get hold of the attention of, it's a paradigm thing. They're still trying to get hold of the attention of the BBC and, the Guardian with their press release and stuff like that. Whereas, and if they're locked into just focusing on those, they're almost unaware of the alternative community media. And I don't imagine those established, I hate to use the phrase, mainstream media kind of outlets are particularly keen on encouraging, people to take up and access and consume local forms of media. But I'd stand corrected on that by yourself, Rob. And so I just wonder whether they're kind of locked into a particular paradigm and they don't understand or are aware that there's a particular alternative. I mean, I would say there's probably, exceptions to that. I was deeply kind of flattered to be contacted by the Carnegie Trust UK before Christmas to come on my community development podcast about their towns, their turnaround towns report. So somebody's clearly done some digging to see what other media are out there, and was more than happy to give them the platform, because it's a great piece of work.
And I think we've got great opportunities to be really creative here. So in Barry, where I live, for example, there's a local group focused on the history of Barry for a Facebook group, but then supplement that with a series of walks and talks so that you get real engagement. And then the events finish and end up in a pub that has been underused, but so get people going into the pub for the first time and get critically getting people talking to other people they wouldn't normally talk because you've just been through this shared experience of a walk together. So the walk itself is a form of a medium. So I think what we've got to do is recognise that actually there's been challenges in that side, but actually these create opportunities. And I think if we're flexible, adventurous and creative, we can capitalise those. Particularly if we can mould them and underpin them with, you know, good social capital practice, they can actually become go a lot further than what traditional media would have done.
You've kind of just answered the next question I was going to ask, and I like to kind of wrap up the podcast these days with a kind of what if, because we seldom get the opportunity to say what would it be like if. So if we have a working model of social capital, which is, you know, quite widespread and it's genuinely taken up, or, you know, it's on the way, if you like, to be taken up, what give us an idea of what you think it would, you know, something would feel like, something would, you know, how would you want to see something working in practice?
I think there's, again, with words, with better words, we can have better understanding. So not only are we promoting social capital, but we're demonising unsociable capital. So the stuff that leads to a decrease in people connecting with each other. So going forward, I think we get it on their radar that as a quality factor that in any activity, what's the social capital implications? At the moment, that's largely ignored. And I think if we can get it on the agenda, get it recognised, give people practical things and ways where we can get reciprocity as a given, so it sounds odd when people don't make the ask as opposed to exceptional when they do, then I think if we can create these new social norms, we can, you know, regard this work with social capital week and beyond as a success.
What about you, Russell?
I'm not sure I've got a huge one to add, actually. I thought I think a bit more of an understanding about what is going on in people's own sort of this squad, we say in Welsh, this sort of square mile, that's sort of, you know, home and hearth, immediate locale, to space, you know, why are things as they are, and to recognize that we're prioritizing other forms of capital, and by we I mean government, I mean, you know, at all levels, certainly kind of, you know, corporate interests, but it's seeping into, you know, how spaces are arranged, how they're designed, and for us to all be a little bit more questioning of that. You know, I've just walked past from back of Cardiff Central Station, past the old Brains Brewery. It's been demolished, and it's going to have, you know, a cultural quarter that will not have anything at all, I'm almost certain, about Cardiff or something that is to do with Cardiff. It will just be generic and shiny and bright and chains. And I think, you know, we need to just question what is kind of going on there. And I think social capital offers us a framework through which to do that.
Cool. So what are the other activities that you've got coming up this week, and how can people get in touch with you and find out more about them?
Well, we're deeply indebted to WCVA, Wales Council for Voluntary Action, the equivalent of NCVO in England. They're hosting a blog by Andy on their blog that's going out sometime today. And we want that to generate some discussion and interaction. Obviously, this podcast will be going out and reaching an audience that maybe would be beyond our reach. So again, we're really indebted to yourself, Rob, and grateful for you putting your time. On Wednesday, we've got a blog by Social Investment Cymru, which is a program, a WCVA program that is around social investments and loans, and who are, I think by their own admission, still at the very outset of their work, that's trying to invest in things that generate what we would call social capital. and not just purely financial returns, and to look to invest in it. And so looking forward to that. That's on Wednesday. Thursday, which would be, what, the 27th, 12:30, we're hosting a Twitter chat where, again, we just want to cast our net as far as wide as possible using Social Capital Week as the hashtags to just engage, and as I said, and have that challenge back, actually, and for people to critique maybe what we think about social capital. This isn't, as I said at the outset, isn't about, you know, just us telling people and shouting at people what, and telling them what we think, you know, they should be thinking. And then on Friday, we kind of rounded up and we're going to be launching, hopefully, still got to put this one to get this over the line. I hope we're going to be launching our random acts of social capital on Friday on the 28th at a community organisation in Cardiff. Which for us is just a weekly on Twitter, but it will be embellished and complemented from time to time. Just simple tips and techniques, activities, actions, things that people can do proactively to just increase and generate a little bit of social capital within their circles, within their spaces, within their networks, within their communities, within the home. And we're hoping people are going to like that. And we'd aim to have one random act per week for 52 weeks. And I think we can probably run to about 18 months now that we've come up with as many. Some are a bit twee, some are a bit different. Some are so stating the bleeding obvious that why is it needed? But actually, if you stand back, take a step back and ask yourself, when did I last do, you know, X or last do Y? You might find yourself thinking, oh, do you know, it's been a while. So it's playful, it's mischievous, but hopefully it also just sort of gets people thinking and maybe just making those small little changes, those little nudges to their behaviours.
Brilliant. Well, it's been, the time's gone really quickly. I've got 3 pages of notes, which is always a good sign. So if this has been a Decentered Media podcast, sorry, what was the Twitter feed? It's Grow.
It's at Grow Social Capit. We're 2 letters short. So until or unless Twitter changes its basic metrics, it's Grow Social Capital, but without the AL.
Okay.
Also on LinkedIn, but not really on anything else yet.
Cool. All right. So this has been a Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. If you want to get into contact with me, you can do so via the blog, which is decentered.co.uk, or you can on Twitter and Instagram via Decentered Media. But until next time, thank you very much. You've been listening to the Decentered podcast. I'm Rob Watson. If you want to find out more information, contact me on Decentered Media via Twitter or go to decentered.co.uk.